Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan US Center's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In October 2024, I spoke to Yelling Tan, professor of public policy at the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. Professor Tan's research focuses on the political economy of globalization, development, and policymaking, with a focus on China and the Asian region. We spoke about how China understands economic security and its evolving economic strategy, and about how public attitudes in China towards international trade influence the country's trade policy. Well, Professor Yelling Tan, thank you so much for joining us on The Ballpark today. Just to start off, could you give us a really brief rundown of your current research interests and a bit of your recent work? Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to have this opportunity to chat with you. So my overall research interests have always revolved around the question of institutional change and how domestic institutions both are influenced by and also influence the international economic environment. And in particular, I'm fascinated by the case of China, being such a large country with a unique history and a very complicated domestic party-state structure that is nevertheless constantly and dynamically evolving and changing. So how does China's party-state structure both affect international politics, particularly in the realm of the economy, and also how has the global economy, how have global economic institutions shaped and affected and transformed, reshaped China's domestic economic policy making?
Thank you so much. So just to start us off, can you talk a bit about how China understands economic security?
Absolutely. So this is a new an emerging research area for me, not surprisingly, because economic security has become a concern that's top of mind for governments around the world, China included. So this led me to want to understand a little bit better what the Chinese government means or thinks of and how it itself understands this concept that we call economic security. And I think getting to grips with that question is important because although we see politicians around the world today all using this term, economic security, different countries and different governments mean different things when they use that term. And so taking a little bit of time to understand these differences and conceptual underpinnings is important because otherwise we run the risk of strategic miscommunication, strategic misunderstanding, and we run the risk of running into unintended conflict. So in my current research, trying to understand China's economic security, I see the Chinese party state as broadly speaking, trying to attain a very basic goal, which is how to reap the benefits of globalization and market reform without at the same time compromising elements that it considers core to its national security. So this is not uniquely Chinese, but I think how China thinks about what elements it considers core to national security might be shaped by its own unique history, even as it is also concurrently being shaped by geopolitical events and domestic politics in the contemporary period. But I think the historical experience is really important to understand. So for China, I think, you know, if we think about its quest to regain strength and to become a strong nation, this effort cannot be dissociated from the question of how China became weak in the first place, or how the Chinese party state thinks that understands its own history, right? And so this brings us back to the 19th and early 20th century, or what China calls its century of humiliation. And I think it's important to go all the way back to this historical period because it overlaps with a whole series of military conflicts and defeats by the Qing dynasty, wherein it saw itself needing to cede sovereign control over its strategic ports and key infrastructure to foreign imperial powers. And this, of course, overlapped with eventually what happened, which was the collapse of the Qing dynasty. Of course, the Qing dynasty itself had a set of domestic problems, which led to its downfall. But the external environment of foreign imperialism and losing what it saw as very important strategic control over key infrastructure, I think has lasted into the memories of Chinese people and the Chinese government today, right? So what emerged was a form of nationalism that really prizes the importance of sovereign control over key infrastructure, or what China today calls its economic lifeline. So ports, railways, energy, aviation, food, and so on. So even as we've seen the Chinese party state trying to modernize and transform China's economy through trade liberalization, through domestic economic reform, it's consistently tried to do so while holding on to these economic lifelines. And this concern, which runs quite deep, I think, because of these historical experiences, runs through a lot of Chinese policy thinking on economic security, even as its strategies on economic security are dynamically changing.
Could you talk a bit about the background of China's recent economic strategy and how it's evolving, and maybe thinking about the decision by China to join the global economic system in the late 20th century?
So if we look at China's economic strategy, especially as it concerns the global economy and how it's evolved over time, we really see dramatic changes, right? At the start of its reform and opening period in the late 1970s and early 80s, the story is quite well known. There were bold experiments in the countryside that led to a burst of rural industrial activity, and then slightly more cautious experimentation along the coast with these special economic zones. And these zones were very successful in spurring trade and manufacturing activity. And so in the 1990s, China expanded these special zones all up and down its eastern coast. But even then, right, in the late 1990s, what China had as it became much more forceful and active as a trading nation, what it had domestically remained a bifurcated trading system, right? You had a series of zones along the coast that were plugged in into the global economy where foreign firms could locate themselves and avail themselves of cheap inputs and efficient labor and so on. In the interior of the country, when it came to domestic trade, the trading system remained state-controlled. It remained dominated by state-owned enterprises that had licenses to trade. And by and large, domestic private companies were shut out from the trading system. With China's entry into the World Trade Organization in 2001, all of this changed, right? So China took a big step in seeking to align its domestic institutions and policies, standards, legal system, and so on, trying to bring that into compliance with the rules and standards of the international economy as enshrined in the World Trade Organization. So that signaled a move away from this bifurcated strategy and a move away from this more cautious experimental approach to trade liberalization. They were trying to do a lot in a very short period of time, and that really triggered a much more intensive period of manufacturing expansion, trade expansion, right? As China reduced its tariffs on imports from the rest of the world, it meant cheaper imports for manufacturing firms that could build out these supply chains, that has led to a lot of the what we see today in the Chinese economy, which has become famed for its sort of just-in-time supply chains, its ability to innovate very quickly on short-time notice, the ability of different parts of China to really source inputs that can't be found in other parts of the world. I think all of these would not be in place today had China not made the decision to become part of the global trading system in a much more holistic way compared to in the 1990s.
Thank you so much. So in your 2022 book, Disaggregating China Incorporated, you've argued that the conventional wisdom on understanding Chinese economic policy and evolution of that is both too binary and too simplistic. Could you briefly outline why you think this is and how this has continued to evolve in the 2 years since you wrote the book?
Thanks for that question. I think it's a really important question to unpack because it has shaped government thinking around the world in terms of this question of how to engage with China on the issue of trade. And I think when we consider the relationship between China and the global economic system, there is a very natural tendency to assess things in terms of success versus failure. Why not, right? We use those frames all the time. You know, so when we consider China's entry into the World Trade Organization, right, there's a tendency to say, well, did it succeed or did it fail in liberalizing China's domestic economy? So in doing my research for this book, I found that binary framing not very helpful in advancing my own understanding and my own thinking, because of what I found was that there was an impact of joining the WTO. There's a profound impact on China's domestic institutions and policymaking, but it was not uniform across all parts of China's economic bureaucracy, which is vast, nor across all parts of the economy, which is rapidly expanding. So that leads to a more interesting question for me, which is why? Why is this impact of liberalization bigger in some places of the Chinese state and not so much in others? And another thing I found was that there was a big burst of momentum to push for liberalization, to strengthen market-supporting institutions. A lot of this undertaken by the central government. But the pace of change was not even over time. It was quite uneven. The momentum for reform slowed down a few years after China joined the WTO. So why is this the case? Right. There's a whole set of literature and political science that talks about feedback loops, right, and how institutions become strong because there are these positive feedback loops that strengthen these institutions as you build them. Why was that not the case in China? Why did we not see institutions get stronger and stronger? So there's a domestic politics story to that, right? So once you abandon this binary frame of success versus failure, I think you start to learn a lot more about how governments interact with global institutions. And I think it helps us gain a deeper, more accurate appreciation of how, when, and why global rules can or cannot have an impact on domestic economic policies. And applied to the case of China, it becomes really important, right? Because then it leads governments, it leads to a different question of, well, should we continue to engage with China through the WTO? Should we do it bilaterally? Should we do it regionally? And what is the best platform and format with which to engage the Chinese government on trade policies?
So as you've said, a WTO entry by China did not result in a uniform trajectory of liberalization across the country. And there was a lot of different, the government actors were acting differently and there were central and subnational actors intensifying economic strategies, but along divergent paths. Can you talk a bit about what this means and maybe in reference to the kind of the feedback loops you've just been mentioning?
Absolutely. So if we think about China's central government, for example, right? It itself, the central bureaucracy is not monolithic either, right? It's made up of different economic agencies and economic agencies that are in charge of trade, those that are in charge of industrial policy, those that are in charge of technology, and so on and so forth, right, as we find in governments around the world. And there has never really been a consensus within the Chinese system on how best to govern the economy, which means that there is scope, even in China's one-party state, for disagreement and competition a competition to have your own definition of economic governance sort of be more influential, right? So competition to have your agency, be it for industrial policy or trade, have greater influence over the economic agenda. So to give you an example, right? So China, a couple of decades ago, reached a political consensus that its project was to build what it calls a socialist market economy. So what does this mean, right? This is going to mean different things to different parts of China's party state and different things to different parts of its bureaucracy. Some agencies and some elite politicians will focus on the socialist part of the socialist market economy, and others that might be more liberal-minded might focus on the market economy part of the socialist market economy. So even within these broad consensus decisions, there remains scope for disagreement. And this means that the single party state contains and has to hold within itself a lot of internal competition and disagreements and needs to find ways to build consensus amongst in quite a noisy environment, a noisy internal environment that's quite opaque and not visible to the rest of the world. So there's a natural tendency to think that because China is a one party state, that these internal agreements either do not exist or that they get repressed through top-down control. But this top-down control is less easy to attain than we might think because China's central bureaucracy remains extremely large and not easy to control through top-down measures. So if we think about, for example, Xi Jinping's signature Belt and Road Initiative, right, it's carried out by a huge diversity of actors, some of which are close to the party center and so might operate on a more political logic. And others, such as the contractors on the ground in the host countries, are very far away from Beijing politics and might operate on a more commercial logic, right? And so because of this diversity and these internal disagreements that plague Chinese policymaking, I think we need to be wary of making the a fundamental attribution error, right? To attribute everything emanating from China as the result of a smoothly conceived and executed master plan, right? There might be broad guidances from the center, but how it actually plays out in reality is subject to messy politics, just as in many countries that we're familiar with outside of China.
Thank you so much. So you've raised the really important points that Chinese governance is not a monolith and there's that messy politics internally. As you say, there's lots of different stakeholders working within China. How and to what extent do these different stakeholders have influence in determining the direction of Chinese policy overall?
So that's a really important question, and it's not a process that is particularly transparent to outside observers and scholars. And I would say it's become probably less easy to understand over time, even as China's economic footprint becomes larger and more impactful in today's global economy. I think what we need to have an appreciation of is that it's hard to predict and understand at any given point in time which specific stakeholders will have the decisive voice and which particular stakeholder has greater influence. I think we need to hold on to that uncertainty because it's in today's China, it's honestly not clear. So for example, if we think about the stimulus that the Politburo just announced a couple of weeks ago, it took many analysts by surprise, right, that the People's Bank of China came forward and made a very forceful series of announcements, right, seeking to stimulate both the Chinese economy and in particular its stock market. Now, what was the decision-making process that led to that? Which stakeholders, right, had the decisive voice and influence, we don't really know. And I don't think we can know at least in the near future, at least until more information and more resources become available to researchers in the future. But I think it also, holding on to that uncertainty helps us to not jump to conclusions when we think about where China's economic policymaking is going today, right? I think there, so my concern is if we become too simplistic in our thinking that top-down control means that the direction of Chinese economic policy is therefore very unchanging and unyielding. And I think that it's not because there isn't disagreement, it's because that disagreement has become less visible to us, and it's because decision-making has probably become a little bit trickier to understand, right? I think what's going on right now in China's economic system is a degree of risk aversion, where a number of years of the anti-corruption campaign and an unrelenting emphasis from the party center on loyalty and discipline has made it such that bureaucratic actors find it easier to not do anything than to do something proactively, right? Even if they see that there's a problem to be tackled, because they run the risk of being punished if they inadvertently step over a line that they didn't know was there. And that makes it actually very hard to get policies implemented, right? And we can see, and there's evidence of Chinese government leaders being frustrated with this state of affairs, right? In the latest stimulus in the Politburo announcement, there was also language in the announcements trying to assure the bureaucracy that it's, you know, you won't be punished for trying to do the right thing, right? So this tells us that policymaking today is still fraught with principal agent problems, right? So if we think about stakeholders, one challenge today is trying to get the right stakeholders to execute policies that the central government might see it needs to be done, but is unable to get done because there's so much risk aversion in the system.
Thank you so much for that. So in a recent article titled Public Responses to Foreign Protectionism, Evidence from the U.S.-China Trade War, you surveyed how public attitudes in China towards international trade shifted in response to the Trump and Biden administration's trade war and tariffs. What did you find?
Thanks for that question. So this was a set of surveys that I ran together with my co-author David Steinberg from Johns Hopkins University, their School of Advanced International Studies. So David and I, between 2019 and 2021, we ran a series of surveys to assess how the trade war with the United States had affected Chinese public opinion. And what we found was that the tariffs from the United States had substantially increased public support for protectionism within China. So when informed about tariffs imposed, back then it was President Donald Trump's administration, respondents in China indicated they wanted China to also adopt a more protectionist trade policy. And in the spring of 2019, when the U.S. escalated its trade war by raising tariffs from 10% to 25% on about $200 billion worth of Chinese imports, we ran another survey, right, shortly right after this escalation, and we found a sharp drop in the baseline support for trade amongst the Chinese public. So average support for trade declined prior to the escalation. It was about 6.5 points from a 0 to 10 scale. And after the escalation, it fell over 2 points to an average of about 4.3. We fielded a third survey in 2021. By this time, this was the Biden administration, and our results were consistent, right? We found again that American tariffs had heightened sentiments supportive of protectionism in China. So this was not a phenomenon limited to the Trump presidency, but rather seemed to be quite enduring. And digging deeper, We found that this turn towards protectionism was only partially driven by the desire to retaliate, right? This desire to retaliate in a tit-for-tat fashion is quite natural. And it's we can find this phenomenon frequently in trade politics. But what we found was that the tariffs appeared to have increased support for protectionism as a general principle, rather than being targeted specifically at the U.S. And we think that there are several reasons why this might be so. It might be a case, for example, of changing norms. So when it's the United States, right, the hegemonic power that was responsible for building and maintaining the post-war international system of trade, when it is that power that repeatedly engages in protectionism outside of the WTO, it no longer seems inappropriate for other countries to also behave in a similar fashion. So it might be a shift in norms. At the same time, it might be that the trade war generates a fair amount of economic uncertainty that leads Chinese citizens to downgrade the benefits of free trade because it simply seems riskier now.
How does public opinion in China change or influence Chinese trade policy? Does it influence trade policy?
That's a really important question, because we might imagine that trade policy remains in the realm of China's political elites and that the determinants of trade policy are far more strategic, geopolitical, business-centric, and that public opinion might not have much to do with it. But if we look at scholarship on public opinion in China, it actually indicates that the party state is highly attuned to the sentiments of its people and takes these attitudes on the ground into account in their policy making, including on issues of foreign policy that might seem very far removed. A more protectionist Chinese public, which is what we found in our survey, makes it harder for the government in China to justify a liberal or more liberal trade policies, right? It would be risky for the Chinese government to ignore these sentiments on the ground. And most analyses suggest that the Chinese government doesn't do so because it is very concerned with social stability and in maintaining regime stability. So I would fold trade policy into a broader group of foreign policy issues that for which the Chinese government does take sentiments on the ground into consideration. It's not the determining factor, but it's one of the things that can, in a soft way, right, constrain or expand the space for the Chinese governments to do various things.
Thank you. So you've talked about how we shouldn't see the internal politics of China as a monolith. Turning that around, should we think about China's trade policy towards the outside world as a monolith or monolithically, or is it more meaningful or useful to break this down by sector or by specific countries that trade policy would be in relation to?
For me, I think it's always useful and enlightening to break it down rather than to think about trade policy as being rigidly applied in a homogenous way across countries and across sectors. And I think this is important because trade politics and trade policies are the product of negotiation, right? Intense, very technocratic, very long drawn out negotiations between governments. If it's a bilateral free trade agreement, right, between two sets of governments, but if it's a regional agreement, then a much greater group of stakeholders. And these different stakeholders come to the table with their own economic concerns, their own domestic lobbyists, and their own varying technical expertise and state capacity, right? And it's the product of this interaction that produces the agreement at the end of the day, right? China does not have a sole voice in shaping a trade agreement. It does not have a sole voice in shaping its trade policy. It does have to take the other parties into account. And so its trade policies will vary depending on the country. And it also varies by time. I think there have been some efforts at coding the depth of China's trade agreements, and we've seen them become deeper and more sophisticated over time as the Chinese government itself has become more sophisticated and savvy in negotiating free trade agreements that that don't just deal with goods and services, but also go into environment, investment, and some of the trickier chapters.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that, when we do this kind of disaggregation, are there any particular sectors or countries that might give us some interesting insights into how China approaches its trading relationships with the outside world?
Sure. So thanks for that question. One sector that I think is in the headlines these days would be the electric vehicles sector, right? So if we think about Chinese EVs, right, are China's surging EV exports a result of oversubsidization and excess capacity, reflecting a grand strategy for China to export its way out of an economic slump? Right, you certainly see that narrative out there. So how would we try to gain a deeper understanding of the dynamics that are going on right now? So to me, if we think about excess capacity, what's happening in China is that there are a lot of Chinese EV makers within China, right, domestically and operating in the domestic space, over 130, if I'm not wrong. And not all of them, in fact, most of them are not competitive enough to survive. So there's excess capacity domestically within China in that sense. And a market correction is happening and will happen. Many of these uncompetitive EV makers in China will go out of business and they will shut down. But what the rest of the world is dealing with in terms of the EV exports, right? Which companies are making those exports? It's not the uncompetitive domestic firms in China that are about to shut down. It is the few firms that have become innovative enough and efficient enough and competitive enough to not only survive in China's very brutal domestic market, but even to become globally competitive, right? It's these few firms that are exporting to the rest of the world. And they're exporting because they have found a way to be profitable and competitive, right? Many of the state subsidies are no longer there to support some of these most successful companies. And they're making profits on their exports, which is something that would not happen if there was insufficient demand meeting excess supply. Right. So I think sectorally, we need to make the distinction between those few hugely dynamic companies that are making having a big impact on exports and EVs to the rest of the world, such as BYD, and the many, many tens and the rest of that 130 firms. Right. Those that are struggling inside of China. That will need to cease their operations because they're simply not competitive. So there is an excess capacity problem, but that's not what is driving the exports, if that distinction is clear.
Great, thanks so much. Well, just before we finish, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to, if there's any research you want to promote or anything, any resources you'd like to direct our listeners' attention to.
Absolutely. Thanks for this opportunity to plug my work. So I do have a new article that's coming out in the Review of International Political Economy. So this is with my co-authors, David Steinberg and Daniel McDowell. Our article is entitled Global Economic Influence and Domestic Regime Support: Evidence from China. So what we do in this paper is we run a series of survey experiments, again, over a series of years to make sure that there are consistent results. And we run a series of questions tackling different aspects of China's global economic expansion. So the Belt and Road Initiative, China's Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and China's COVID vaccine aid to the rest of the world during the pandemic. And what we were interested in testing was what the relationship was between China's expanding footprint overseas and support for the central government domestically by its citizens. Because there's a lot of research looking at the impact of China's global economic expansion on other countries and other publics, but less on the domestic politics and the domestic political repercussions of China becoming such a powerful actor overseas. And what we found was quite interesting. What we found was that when given information, accurate information, by the way, of ways in which China's global economic expansion has stumbled, right? Has failed to achieve its objectives. Chinese citizens actually lowered their sense of support and satisfaction for the central government. We probed this relationship a little bit deeper to figure out what was going on. Was it because they felt more economically insecure, right, if things in the global economy did not seem to be going well for the Chinese government? Or was it out of a sense of nationalism? And we found that it was the latter, right? Consistently across these three issue areas, as China tries to expand its global economic footprint, right, when given information about these efforts stumbling or failing, right, the Chinese public feels its sense of nationalism being hurt, which then has a knock-on effect on its level of support for the central government in China, which is quite interesting because when we ran a fourth experiment, looking at the domestic economy, what we found was a different dynamic, right? Again, we found that when given negative information about key economic indicators such as unemployment or inflation, Chinese citizens also tended to feel less supportive of the central government, but this was through a different channel. It wasn't nationalism driving the sense of this lower sense of satisfaction, but it was through a sense of decreased and less positive economic prospects.
Our listeners can check out a link to that publication in our show notes. Professor Yeling Tan, thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeling Tan is Professor of Public Policy at the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Yeling Tan for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. Look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It really helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.